Hello, and welcome to episode 86 of Shelf Love, a podcast that unpacks romance novels with nuance. In conversations with scholars, readers, and other experts, Shelf Love contextualizes the popular romance genre within the broader critical discussion of identity, culture, and love, and sex. I'm your host, Andrea Martucci, and on this episode, we're talking about safe sex with Dame Jody Slaughter. Dame Jody Slaughter, how are you this fine evening? And who are you?
I'm doing really well. The question of who am I is deeply philosophical. I can't answer it particularly well right now, but I am an author. Like, I write romance, and I'm a scholar, apparently, of romance. Scholar. Who's never written a single dissertation, but still.
Look, credentials not necessary, as evidenced by this girl right here. So we're going to talk about safe sex today. And yeah. I feel like it's important, like, just laying the groundwork for what this conversation is trying to accomplish and not trying to accomplish. I think it's fair to say that there is a lot of stigma in the romance genre against people with STIs or people who have unexpected pregnancies. There is stigma. There is stereotype. I would not say this episode is going to try to address positive or negative representations of people living with STIs or people who had unexpected pregnancies or whatever. We're not really covering that. We're talking about, in romance novels, in the text, on the page, how safe sex is represented. I think we're primarily going to be talking about characters who we assume do not have an STI and are actively avoiding pregnancy, if possible, until or unless they get to the stage of the relationship where they decide they want to become pregnant. So I just kind of want to throw that out there because that's a whole other conversation. But I do also feel like it's important to acknowledge that there is a lot of stigma against people who have STIs.
Absolutely.
And the intention of this conversation is not to say that people living with STIs cannot have fully enjoyable sex lives and fulfilling relationships, etc. However, I think it is reasonable for sexual partners to have a discussion about how to prevent transmission if possible.
Sure.
This is going to be like a fun interactive thing. Just before we started this conversation, half an hour ago at this point, I put a poll out on Twitter. We're going to come and revisit this poll at the end of our conversation and see how many votes we get in the next hour or so. But I asked Twitter what source of info was most influential on their ideas about safe sex. I throw this over to you, Dame Jody Slaughter. Did the night education involve safe sex practices?
Okay, this is odd. So I'm trying to think about where I was getting my information on sex in the first place, and then trying to figure out if in that there was discussion about safe sex. So I didn't tend to have super candid conversations about sex that were specifically geared towards me as a young person from my family. I did listen a lot. My family is very candid, my grandmother especially. So there's that. I have an uncle who is an OBGYN. So I do know that there was always discussion and not so much shame about things like abortion and stuff from when I was very young, but not here's what you need to do when you have sex. I'm also born and raised in Kentucky. There's no federal mandate on safe sex education. Most southern states are allowed to teach what they want. I'm not sure if my school district was abstinence only, but I do remember that we had just a unit in my health class my freshman year of high school. And my teacher was candid, teaching us about STIs. I remember very distinctly that once she was like, and you never use two condoms, because if you're going to use two condoms, you might as well not use any because they're good. Or no, yeah, you might as well not use any because it's not going to feel like anything.
That's you. And you might as well not use any because two is less safe than one.
Exactly.
Perhaps more importantly.
But I think that most of my sex education period and my safe sex ed came from the internet.
You actively searching or embedded in other media on the internet?
So as we know, as we discussed in a previous episode, I got into fan fiction pretty young. And so there was a lot of discussions in certain fandoms surrounding oh, we should use condoms, or oh, if there's a fisting scene, this person's gonna put something on their hand to make sure things are safe. And so that I feel like so much of what I learned about like safe sex comes from that, came from like engaging in fandom and fan fiction and romance fiction, because that's the kind of stuff I was reading, but not romance novels. The romance novels I was reading as a younger person tended to be YA, and if they were adult, they were like the Sookie Stackhouse series, where I don't remember condoms. I'm trying to remember, but I don't.
Yeah, when you're having sex with vampires, I don't know if pregnancy is a concern. And I don't know, can vampires get sick? And so can they transmit or have STIs? Depends on the lore.
I've never come across a vampire that could pass an STI.
They're not living.
Right.
Viruses and bacteria can't grow on them. Have you ever thought about that?
I can't remember which vampire lord is, but they're definitely like, they have a certain sun sickness or some, you know,
because sure.
Everyone has their own lore. Everyone makes up their own thing about vampires. Like Stephanie Meyer's vampires could go in the sun. They wouldn't die, but Christine Harris's would. They would die if they went in the sun. So everyone's different, but anyway.
Which is a good lesson, because yes. Everyone is different, even if you're not a vampire.
Yes, definitely. Everyone is different. But yeah, so like hodgepodge stuff. And then when I was around 15 or 16, I got on Tumblr.
Oof.
And then there was, for all its faults, of which there are the majority, I did get a lot of like pretty okay comprehensive sex ed not related to fandom. And then obviously I had peers.
You had friends? I never had friends.
I had a couple, at least one.
Good for you.
So yeah, I don't know. Somehow I've managed to live and learn a couple things.
It's amazing how basic some of this stuff is and how much people are kept in the dark somewhat intentionally. And then like the information's available, but you have to go searching for the right things to find it. But so I think it's fair to say that a lot of people get the majority of their information about sex from media or peers. I think that if you have the kind of parent who is actually going to have a real conversation with you about it, the information is probably pretty good. That is, of course, not the kind of conversation that's like, don't do it.
Yeah, right? That's the thing, is that I also didn't get an anti-sex at home. I did not grow up in a conservative family. I didn't grow up in a family that was super religious. I think my mother is religious, but she doesn't go to church, and she wouldn't have forced us to go to church. And even I remember when I turned 16, my mom was like, if you want to go on birth control, you need to let me know, because my grandmother put her on birth control when she was 14. And my mother was always like, listen, I've been a teenager. I know what happens if you need things. But I don't think she knew how to talk to me about sex. And I think she kind of just was like, yeah, maybe she's learning in school. And granted, we still don't talk about sex.
Even now that you are in the... I'm trying to think how I want to mischaracterize romance novel writing right now.
I write smut. And that's the thing, is that I've actively been like, I don't want you to read my books.
Ooh.
Luckily, she's not a reader, so she probably won't. But I was like, I don't want you to read my books. And she's like, why? I don't. And I'm like, there are things that I don't think you ever need to know that I know. Just like, and I feel like my books are like, as of now, we're like pretty tame. Or do you know what I mean? I don't know. Maybe not tame, but I don't know.
Yeah. Heat levels. Let's talk about the heat level of your book, Jody. Well,
oh God, the thought of this. Teaching my mom anything new about sex. Do you know what I mean? Like, she knows about all, I imagine she knows about all of these things.
At least a few of them.
A couple, I assume. So yeah, we don't. And when we do talk about it, it's very, very euphemistic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is on my part, where I'm like,
yeah, it's awkward. I'm trying to be the cool mom who can have these good, conversations. Though. We talk about body parts as body parts. And I'm not going to mention the body parts now on the air, but in our home.
Right.
No, I'm just kidding. Vaginas, penises, vulvas, you know.
Yeah, we said pocketbook. You're whatever, like, for...
When a hot dog slips into a hot dog bun.
Pretty much. I do remember once being, like, 12. And so my best friends, anytime I would go to church as a kid, unless it was maybe Easter Sunday, it would be with my best friend, whose family was pretty religious. And I would stay with her a lot. I would go over, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to spend a weekend at so-and-so's house over the summer. And I'd end up staying for a month. And they went to church like 3 times a week. And I do remember her mom once, when we were like 12, being like, hey, do you know what a pimp and a whore is? And this was out of the blue. I don't remember if we had been
like
listening.
Was it like in a Bible verse or something?
No, I don't know. I just remember standing in her little foyer. And I do remember that I did know what they were, but I said no. Not to get so into that trauma, but that whole relationship was like, this person is not my friend anymore, ultimately, because we grew very far apart. There was always a part of me that felt a little judged because my family wasn't as keen on shielding me from certain aspects of life. And I felt like I not matured at a different rate, but just, I don't know, she had a lot more, like, rules.
And, she had been taught to associate stigma with things.
Yes.
And your upbringing did not attach that same stigma. And she expected your values to align.
Exactly.
And if they didn't, you were judged to be immoral in some way.
Yes, exactly. I was, like, 15, and I didn't feel like I could go to who had been my childhood best friend about somebody, you know, putting their fingers down my pants for the first time.
Yeah, I think that's, like, a common issue in friend groups. There's a certain tone about if this is okay, and I think there's a lot of secrecy about what people are actually doing, because there's this dynamic where friends don't want their friends to know they're doing certain things because they're afraid of being judged. And so meanwhile, sometimes they're engaging in similar sexual practices, but like not sharing information. So I grew up in a family that was Catholic and went to church every week. I was in the choir. I was a Eucharistic minister. I was the one standing up giving the body and or blood of Christ to people. I have always been an atheist, by the way. Literally always. My parents were highly involved in like the choir. And anything I did was because I had to go to church. And I was like, well, I might as well make this interesting. So I would say I have never believed in sort of the morality aspects of anything I learned in church. I would not say personally I was very influenced by that, but I think my parents hew at least moderately to ideas about like sex and pregnancy and queer people and stuff like that. So perhaps needless to say, not the most open dialogue about safe sex practices. So just for like generational purposes, I'm a millennial. I went through sex ed at a school in a suburb of New York City in Connecticut. And I would say I received a fairly good sex education curriculum at my school.
Brag.
Yeah, sorry. You know, I mean, like at least a week or a couple weeks every year after a certain point, such things were covered. And then when we got to biology later on, things were handled very frankly. Like in biology class, it's not like you're talking about STIs or anything. Like I know how babies are made.
Right. This is a fallopian tube.
Yeah, yeah. This is how this happens. I truly believe that most of my friends were probably not having sex. So I know some of them did, and they were fairly forthcoming, but the rest of us were just like, oh, cool, tell me more. Yeah. So we're fairly open-minded, but just not a lot of experience between us. So I think that a lot of my sex education, and I'm going to maybe put that in scare quotes, came from romance novels.
Mm.
And these would be romance novels because of the time at which I was a teenager, were published like pre-2000. I definitely read stuff from like a range of periods. I read Kathleen Woodowis from the early 70s. I definitely read categories that were published in maybe the 80s and 90s. So I'm reading stuff that in this point in time is 40 years old and at that point was maybe 20 years old. This is all to say that I'm incredibly curious about the possible impact of what one reads in romance novels impacting one's understanding of what safe sex looks like and how sex works. I think that like some of the benefits of getting information about sex from romance novels, first of all, I don't recommend it as your only source of information for sure. And unfortunately, if it is your only source, it's not a super accurate source. However, there is something about romance novels where generally it's sex positive and or at least present sex as like a pleasurable thing most of the time.
Right. That's very much how I view the fan fiction thing. Certainly not should not be anyone's main, or even I would say I wouldn't even want someone like being introduced to sex through that avenue, because there's so much actually traumatic shit to get through when it comes, because there's no barriers. There's no publishing house to be like, you can't.
Maybe we shouldn't do this.
Or even just an editor, or especially on like Archive of Our Own, they allow anything. But I did learn a lot of things about sex. A lot of, even if we're just getting down to the brass tacks of, okay, sex is something that people like enjoy. It is something that is supposed to be pleasurable for all parties involved. It is something that does not have to look the way you've seen it look on TV, which is to say one cishet man, one cishet woman, just panting from the waist up at each other, like
under sheets with a bra on, and
yeah, and then it's always just the guy just humping for 15 seconds and somehow she has an orgasm.
Yes, I think there's definitely an aspect of that script that also carries over into cishet romance novels. There's a lot of the, like, because we are so in love and on the same page, we're gonna have a simultaneous, what's it called? A simultaneous orgasm?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, we're gonna orgasm purely from penetration together at the exact same moment.
That's pure fantasy. And I know, listen, it's ridiculous. Sometimes I'm a sucker for it. Sometimes I'm like, oh God, they just love each other so much that they come at the exact same time every time. That's never happened in real life. That's never happened to me.
It's not impossible, but it's also more of a rarity than it is portrayed in romance novels. And so I should also say then, the romance novels that I am learning from in that period, which you can imagine based on the years that they were published and what I would have had access to generally in tradpub, almost, I want to say, entirely white people and also entirely cisgender people in heterosexual relationships, you know. So
I am curious about, because as we've talked about, that is not my romance canon. I don't know. I think Beverly Jenkins and Lavrell Spencer are kind of the only two romance authors who have works published, like, even in the 90s that I've read. I've heard a lot of talk about, since you said, like, romance is published in the 70s and 80s, was there a lot of sex that was enthusiastic on the part of the heroine, or was it more often than not a coercive type where it has to be, for lack of a better term, taken from her until she enjoys it?
I would characterize most of what I read as not the coercive rape fantasy. Like, if I'm thinking about authors, I would say probably Judith McNaught and Kathleen Woodiwiss stand out as having the most sexual relationships that kind of hewed to that formula of the sort of, like, resisting, it is literal rape, can't enjoy it until they're in love type situation.
Right.
I would say that the majority, just to name some authors I was reading that did not fall into that camp, like, I read a lot of Jane Ann Krentz, a.k.a. Amanda Quick, a.k.a. Jane Castle, and that was not her formula for sure. Obviously, like I've mentioned before, Jennifer Crusie through the 90s and closer to the 2000s, where the women were enthusiastically engaged in sex with their male partners. I am ashamed to say I read a lot of Linda Howard. She is probably the author who I have the most conflicted relationship with, because I would say probably a standard script in her books were maybe more of that resisting slash very passive female participant, you know, much more just like, oh my God, I have no idea what's going on. I've never enjoyed sex before. If I've had sex, or I've never had sex before, I have no idea what's going on. I'm completely at your mercy. Super alpha abusive men who are kind of like, I can't help it. I'm a man. I have to fuck you right now. It was like, honestly, like, I need to do an episode on Linda Howard and her impact on my ideas about sex, because they're super fucked up. And also some of the things she has done in Romancelandia, one could say, have been racist. And I think that also her work backs up that worldview. Very complicated. But I'm gonna admit that I read a lot of Linda Howard. I've read everything Linda Howard has written.
And Oh wow, okay, yeah,
I didn't know any better, so
I mean, I read Twilight, which is like, it's all, we've all read, just
we've all read shit, man.
just garbage. I told you my secret shame earlier.
Right.
Which we won't be sharing here.
Exactly. And then I'm trying to think of the other stuff I read. I read a lot of Joanna Lindsay, I feel like hers were fairly sex positive. I didn't prepare a list of the authors that I primarily read.
I'm having to Google like all of these people. And I'm truly just, I have no context for like any of these
authors. Thing is, this is, so what was in my library, like what was on the library shelves? Mm-hmm. I worked in this library book sale, like sorting books. So what was there? These are just like the books that were available to me. So we've talked a lot about how have we encountered in our real lives what safe sex looks like, and then what are we getting from media? And the main reason I wanted to talk about this with you, there's two reasons. One, I was talking to Julie Moody Freeman, and she was talking about how Brenda Jackson made a point to include condom usage in her romances, I want to say in the 90s, in kind of response to the HIV crisis.
Right.
And knowing that her nieces are going to be reading the books and wanting to show that the male partners in these heterosexual relationships cared about protecting their female partners. And so they said, let's use condoms. And this was like an important thing. And you could maybe get into how, because of ideas at the time and perhaps even publisher guidelines, the women in those relationships, it was encouraged maybe for them to be more passive, less active participants in safe sex.
Sure.
Like in preventing pregnancy or preventing STI transmission. So we're talking about this, and I had read about this study that came up in this book that I'm reading about the difference between fantasy and reality. And I was like, oh, I need to go find this study because it talked about how romance readers were less likely, after reading a scene without condom usage in a romance novel, less likely to use condoms in their real life. And I was like, oh my God, I need to find that study.
I have thoughts on this.
So I found the study.
Okay, good. I have thoughts because you're right. So I noticed that in a lot of romance novels that are coming out today, in 2010s, etc.
In the last decade?
Yeah. Oh. Has it been? It's been a decade. Okay. Yeah. There's a lot of focus. And of course, I don't have a ton to compare it to before. But there might be very short discussion on condom usage, whether that's for like pregnancy or STI prevention. First of all, as you said, there's always something that's geared towards like morality. And normally that is the cisgendered heroine who either she's a virgin or I haven't slept with anyone in 10 years, a type of thing. And whether or not the cisgendered hero is a billionaire who's like sleeping with someone new every week or similar, I think the lack of condom usage symbolizes a certain security in their relationship. I think it's like a symbol of these two people are going to be together. They're good. They're not going to break up.
And they've used condoms or whatever protection with every other partner. So they're safe now with their one true partner to not do that.
It's very one true love. And it is also very, he's like, I'll take care of it if we get pregnant. Because oftentimes, like, she's not on birth control or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it's very much symbolizes like a security type thing. And now, granted, I have been guilty of this myself. In White Whiskey Bargain, they do not use protection or condoms.
They are married. Okay, so they're married.
Exactly.
However, since they have a marriage of convenience, you would think that they would perhaps have a conversation about family planning or test results or something. And I'm not knocking you, but like just in the context of the story, like that would be realistic.
It would be, but it was very much a like when I was writing that book, it was like the second book I wrote, which I mean, fine. Okay. I'm not trying to like make justifications. I'll just say is that I was using a lot of those things that I'd read and that sort of symbolism of like security to say, these are two people who are quote unquote safe with each other, in that I imagine the reader was supposed to assume they didn't have any STIs, either of them had anything that they needed to disclose or whatever. And then also that there was an underlying thing of both of these characters were very interested in like family and continuing lineage. So there was no accidental pregnancy, but even if there had been, it would have been like, okay, because this is what...
Like, culturally and their individual family experiences, that would not have been perceived as a tragedy for either of them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I think there's totally a symbolic nature to how choices in sex are presented in romance novels. So on the sort of quote-unquote safe sex front, I think that there's a lot of symbolism around, as you said, I'll protect you, I'll take care of you.
Yeah.
I am committed to this, and therefore if there is a pregnancy, like, obviously we're going to raise the child together.
Right.
And it is not a great tragedy. I think that this study that I read also was talking about this concept that true love is demonstrated by being swept away in passion.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's totally a symbolic nature of that, just like how I was joking with you. I read, this was a while ago, I was reading this romance novel and they fall asleep, cisgender man and a cisgender woman fall asleep with like his penis nestled inside of her.
I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a grand old laugh about this because we were literally trying to figure out the logistics of this whole situation.
And also, and everybody's getting a UTI.
We were very concerned medically for this situation. And but I feel like even in that conversation, we acknowledged that the symbolic nature of falling asleep joined together.
Yeah.
They don't want to be separated. They're one now. That's the simultaneous orgasm thing. Like we can understand why this is happening. However, and so you acknowledge that as a baby romance novelist, you're picking up the cues from what you have read. And what you've read isn't even like that old.
Yeah.
And so we kind of have these choices that get perpetuated because they become ingrained as, that's just the way we talk about this in romance novels, right?
Yeah.
That's how we symbolize these things. So what's interesting about this study, which is called Love Means Never Having to Be Careful, the relationship between reading romance novels and safe sex behavior, this was published in Psychology of Women Quarterly in 2000. And it's written by Amanda B. Diekman, Mary McDonald, and Wendy L. Gardner. So this study is 20 years old at this point. Just so, you know, just let me lay that out there.
And I'm 26, so.
Yeah, so Jodi Slaughter was in kindergarten when this study was written.
The knife is twisting because Katrina Jackson, I'm calling her out again, today in a message said that I was, and I quote, practically a teenager. Can you believe?
That's rude.
The microaggression. Anyway, okay.
That's age discrimination.
That's ageism, Katrina.
Yeah. Okay. The study basically has three parts. And so again, keep in mind that this study was published in the year 2000. Number one, part one of this study is they looked at romance novels that had been published. Like, they went into a bookstore and grabbed, like, every sixth romance novel they found or something. And then they looked at just the contemporary romance novels. And they had some criteria, whatever. They then had people code what happened in the sex scenes in these romance novels. They narrowed it down to books that had sex scenes on the page. They narrowed it down to contemporaries because they didn't feel it was fair to look at a historical novel in the same light. They were all cisgender heterosexual relationships, which is not surprising given, again, that they're looking at the romance section in the late 90s. And I think actually they first did this in 96 because the most recent books were published in 1996 and the books had been published over like a 10-ish year period.
Okay.
And what they found was only 8 of the 78 novels portrayed the character discussing condom use during their first sexual encounter. And importantly, all of the discussions were initiated by the male character. Only 4 discussions mentioned STD prevention. The others mentioned birth control. And in 3 discussions, so that's like a third of the discussions where it actually happened, the female character ultimately rejected the suggestion. One rejection took place during a birth control discussion and 2 during STD discussions. I think this definitely backs up that sort of, no, we're in love. I can't catch an STD from you. Which, do you know what that reminds me of? People,
what?
Like, believing that they can't get COVID from people that they love.
Oh, my God. Yeah. that very much seems same vein, but this is also telling me, it's making me question, so I don't question the numbers. What I'm questioning is, what is this saying about, like, cishet women and how we are supposed to be. I'm not heterosexual, but as a cisgendered woman, like,
mm-hmm. maybe particularly in a relationship with a cisgender male.
Yes, yes.
If you were.
We would be remiss if we hadn't talked about, like, how there has been exponentially a huge rise in sex education among a lot of, like, Gen Z. My younger sister is 19. I think she knows more about sex, safe sex, her body, and other people's bodies than I did when I was her age. And I wasn't even her age a full 10 years ago. And also, like, our views on cisgendered women who are on birth control. Mm-hmm. Would it have been, what was their coding about? A woman is only on birth control if she is immoral, if she is actively having sex. Because I know that my mother, who I imagine probably would have gone on birth control sometime in the late 70s, about how my grandmother was judged quite heavily for allowing her to be on birth control. And also, I know that there were plenty of cis girls my age who couldn't get on birth control in their teens because their mothers viewed it as, this is an allowance for you to mm-hmm. have sex. So was the sort of rejection of, like, birth control, the lack of discussion, was that supposed to symbolize a woman who isn't having sex, a pure heroine worthy of love?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot in here, honestly. I was, like, cramming. I read this 2 weeks ago in detail and, like, didn't take notes. And then I was, like, trying to remember everything just before this call. But I do recall there's a lot of discussion in here. And they're also laying this on top of a foundation of other research that might have looked at these things, like, separately. But part of their conclusion in this section, thus the romance script depicted in the modern romance novel does not portray women as suggesting or using a condom. As expected from past examinations of the past role of women in the romantic script, the male character initiated the discussion or use of a condom in every instance. Furthermore, the female character was portrayed as rejecting condom use in almost half of the discussions. This was a disturbing finding. Quote unquote, true love, according to some novels, is apparently expressed through the female character actually disregarding the risks to her health. In fact, the female character who rejected condom use gave reasons such as, I want no barriers between us.
Yeah. Oh, that's a line that is still very much alive.
I found that in one of the recent romance novels that I'll share the exact quote later. But I think they are very aware in this study that there are cultural scripts that mm-hmm. are different based on people's genders about what it might look like if a cisgender woman in particular is too engaged in this discussion, too active in right. this discussion. So the second study, so this is basically like laying the foundation of how commonly is condom usage and or STI prevention discussed on the page mm-hmm. in romance novels, low. And by the way, also, I found this to be an interesting factoid. They also state in here that based on a study from like the mid 90s, it looks like, the proportion of couples who engage in safe sex behavior remains low. Merely 1/3 of sexually active college-age people report recent use of condoms. So I was like, I wonder how that number has changed.
No, that's another thing that I was going to bring up is that it's messy. The safe sex.
It is messy if you don't use a condom.
What? if I'm going to like really open myself up here, I would say that if I'm talking about like sexual encounters that I've had with other, specifically like cisgendered women, I've never used a dental dam or had one used on me or one of the finger protection. Mm-hmm.
I think some people use like gloves.
Like, yeah, they have gloves, but they have small, they look like condoms.
Oh, like finger condoms.
Yeah.
Okay.
I imagine they have a name and are not just called finger condoms, but that shows how much I've never used one.
Some barrier method.
Yes. So, you know what I mean? Like, it's messy. I know that there are, you know, plenty of people who are like, yes, I use condoms, except I don't use condoms to give blowjobs, which you are supposed to.
Yes. And I remember in sex ed in school, they were like the safest thing to do is, this is of course the scenario that was presented in sex ed 20-ish years ago, was like a cis woman giving a cis man a blowjob, use a condom. I do not know one person / have not myself ever used
Never
a condom in a blow, you know.
I know that in the context of like sex work, it is very, I think if we're talking about who's having the safest sex,
it's probably sex
workers, like period. And the rest of us are just not, like I said, it's messy. There are so many instances of people I know, whatever, where you do, some people do get swept up in the moment. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I had one encounter and it was like the safest sex we could have possibly had. And then the next encounter I had with either that same person or someone completely different was not at all.
I think there's an aspect of it that has to do with, what is your greater concern? Is your greater concern STIs or is it pregnancy?
Right. Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, especially my age, it is pregnancy. Because I know a lot of us are like, if I'm on some sort of hormonal birth control, or if I cannot get my partner pregnant or my partner cannot get me pregnant, I feel like I can quote unquote trust them enough to disclose whether or not they have tested positive for an STI. But even that would mean that they would need to be getting tested regularly, which I think, again, I don't know what the numbers for that are, but I would say that probably majority of us are not getting tested regularly. I would genuinely say that most of us are not engaging in sex that is
the safest.
Yes.
Like safest. Best practice.
Yes. Or even sometimes safe at all, which is why I'm a little more, I certainly don't condone it. Like, I feel like we should all be like doing our best to take care of ourselves and our partners.
But to that point, I think that there's a common understanding of, yes, of course we do certain things, but other things, that's a little much. Like, who's really going to do that? Where do we get our ideas necessarily about, like, where that line is?
I think it's very much
the media.
I think, yeah, I mean, it is. It's very much, okay, so I'm going to use this talking about cis women. I'm going to talk about, like, having sex on the first date, because this is a conversation that's constantly happening, and it seems like it doesn't matter what generation you're in. If you're a cis person who like dates people who are like a gender that is not your own, there's always conversation about, is it okay to have sex on the first date? And so we're getting to a place where like a cis woman can be like, yeah, I slept with my cis male partner on the first date and that's great, but they can't say I had anal sex with my cis male partner on the first date. Because that is like, whoa, that's fucking wild, right? Mm-hmm. But if we talk about two people for whom, like, anal sex is their preferred way to have sex in any situation, that's not wild. So why would it be wild? That's just, like, a, sort of an off-topic example of what we view as being wild, who we view it as being wild for, and, like, the stigma attached to that particular act itself.
I think you're completely right, and I think that is definitely related to our ideas about quote-unquote real sex / quote-unquote adventurous sex.
Right.
Because I think that there is this perception of, like, same scenario you just outlined, a blowjob on a first date or some sort of, like, oral sex is, I think, particularly when the oral sex is performed on a cis male, is perceived as, like, not a big deal. Like, on the spectrum of sex acts is considered more minor. And there's, like, air quotes all over this entire thing I just said, right? This is, like, I'm talking about, like, perception. And then what you're talking about is there's been this, like, gradual evolution towards attitudes about vaginal intercourse on a first date being normalized, let's say, right? Neither here nor there. Whereas, as you were pointing out, anal sex between cisgender heterosexual partners might be perceived as a more adventurous act, right?
Deviant is the word deviant, I would use.
Yes.
Yeah.
And whereas then that becomes, nope, that's hard too line. Far.
Yeah.
Or, oh, that's risky all of a sudden. When in fact, all of these things carry similar amounts of risks
they're
for different
same.
Things.
Yes.
Right.
That's exactly it. And that points to, like, us as a quote unquote society viewing this particular act as deviant. And then because we view the people who are more commonly known for performing this act, meaning if we're just going to talk about two cis gay men, as like culturally deviant. Like for two cis gay men who want to have sex.
Penetrative sex. Gay. Why is oral not penetrative? But anyways, whatever. It is penetrative.
This is how they would do that. Or one of the ways in which they would do that. It's all the same. This is why I don't always love this sort of... I'm like, if you're 16 and you're using first base, second base, third base, whatever... But when you're like...
Romance novels use that very similar progressive understanding of sexual relationships as well, which is just another example, I think, of where we're getting these scripts for how things progress. And
that's true. Because it is often, even if we're not always super cognizant of it, it is often the ways in which like... a lot of us in our real relationships do progress sexually as viewing like the penetrative sex as being the final act, which is ridiculous because not everyone has penetrative sex. Not everyone is interested in penetrative sex. So I don't know, but yeah, you're right. Like romance novels definitely do follow this script.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought about that before. But yeah, but in general, I'm like, as grown adults, we should, I think, get more to like viewing sex as just like an even playing field that we could play adult soccer on, of just like sex. It's all sex, and whatever type you are having is going to differ. But I think that we do ourselves a disservice at holding certain acts to certain hierarchy standards, because we do ourselves a disservice with like when it comes to safe sex, because we should be treating oral sex the same in terms of both risk and reward as we treat penetrative sex. Mm-hmm. But we simply do not.
Yeah. And I think even along with that, it's not like you need to save your conversation about STIs and testing until just before you're having a particular type of sex, like maybe the best time to have that is before having any kind of sex as part of a first step there. And so just to wrap up the condom conversation specifically, I can't help it. I'm a dad joker.
I found a condom in my purse this morning and got so sad.
Oh.
But yeah, anyway.
So just in case you're curious how things have progressed in the 20-ish years since this study came out. I found a study from 2020 with high school students. It's not one-to-one because the other study was with slightly older people. They were college-aged people, but it was the best I could find on short notice. In the 1992 and 1997 study, so these are people who are having sex, which proportion involved in safe sex? I think 1/3 of sexually active college-aged people. 20-ish years later, the high school students reported, the female participants noted about 50% any use of condoms versus 60% for the male students, which seems to be a doubling-ish of the previous 20 years, which maybe is indicative of greater awareness in that time. Okay, so I think that before we get into the latter parts of the study, which are more about like how reading things in romance novels might impact one's attitudes and behaviors around safe sex, let's talk about our specific experience with the texts of romance novels we've read recently, which we've already started talking about. Is this going to be two episodes? I don't even know, Jody. I don't even know what's going to happen here. Okay. There might have to be some tough cuts. I might have to cut out the part where you talked about the guy lighting the condom on fire.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you, listener, for listening to episode 86 of Shelf Love. A transcript and show notes for this episode can be found on shelflovepodcast.com. Thank you for joining me and Jody today. If you have any thoughts on the show, you can either talk to your school pastor, or you can talk to your parent and guardian, a certified mental health counselor, medical professionals.
Mail a pamphlet to each and every one of you.
Yes, we'll prepare some, what do they call them? Prepare some take-homes for you, some deliverables. No,
PowerPoint.
Please show up for our Safe Sex in the Year 2021 in Romance Novels lecture, which will be happening on... I'm going to cut this whole thing out.
We're going to be like, wait, when is this happening, really?
Mark your calendars. Thanks for joining me today. If you have any thoughts on this show, that are within the realm of what I can answer, not as a medical professional, I'd love for you to reach out to me. You can send an email to Andrea@shelflovepodcast.com. This episode is produced by me, Andrea Martucci. Thank you to Shelf Love's editorial advisory board members, Katrina, Stealing Jody's Gifts Jackson, and Tasha L. Harrison. That's all for this week. Black Lives Matter. Stay safe, stay mad, and keep reading romance.